It is Wednesday, the 8th of September, 2021. I am Patrick Crozier.
I'm Brian Micklethwaite. And we're doing this on the phone because I'm in hospital at the moment.
Yes.
But I'm in a single ward. There aren't just curtains around it with lots of chit-chat going on outside. It's actually quite private and convenient, so we are doing it now.
Well, that is very nice. The topic we're going to talk about today is communications technology, and particularly your use of it over the years.
Yes.
And I think you wanted to start...
I think it's an exercise in escapism on my part. I remember saying to you some while ago that one of the attractions of studying history is that you can just get away from all the complications and disappointments of the world as it now is.
Yes.
And I feel a bit the same way about reflecting on my past life, even though I might like to change things and I can see things I might have done better. Basically, it's all done. And there's not a lot we can do to change it now. We can change what we can. All we can do is talk about it and reflect on what I learned from this episode. And I applied.
Hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Hello? All right, you are there. I think you were talking about reflecting on things and...
Yes.
Right, okay. Maybe there's the connection isn't as...
Deep into the past. I'm hearing you, but are you hearing me?
From time to time, there was a bit of a dropout
there.
It's
not working, bro.
So...
Oh, well, that's not very good, is it?
It's not very good. I think we should just bash on and hope for the best.
Okay. Yes, all right. I'm not able to shout very loud.
No. I can hear you perfectly loudly. That's fine. That's no problem.
Good. Good.
And as long as I'm loud as well, that's also good.
Yes, I can hear you perfectly clearly.
Oh, good. Okay. Of course, having this completely meaningless part of the conversation has been absolutely fine. No communication problems at all. As soon as we start getting into the meat of it, you know what's going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get into the meat of it anyway. That's quite profound what you're saying, isn't it?
I don't know if it'll be profound to a few dozen people, and it won't be of any interest to a few million people, but so what? One of the points I'm always interested in is, can you do a communication? I mean, this is particularly applies later to what I did for the Chris Tame, Brian Micklethwaite Libertarian Alliance, was could you produce a communication which was quite small in its reach, but because it didn't matter if it was small, we could still do it, you know. One of the most important things about those libertarian pamphlets I did was that they didn't have to be mass circulation. I mean, we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, but it's an example of how you can't take the normal way communicating is done for granted, or I didn't. Because we could just do a few copies of things, then all that mattered was that the author of the pamphlet was saying something he took seriously and wanted to get right. And if there were a few other people who wanted to read about it, well, good. And if there weren't, no big disaster.
I mean, is there a point being made here about the photocopier? Because before the photocopier, if you wanted to produce things in large amounts, either you had to copy them out yourself or you had to go to a printer. Is that essentially the argument?
Yes, that's right. And if you go to a printer, you're awfully liable to be tempted to produce too many copies because, you know, what if it's a hit and all that.
Because the marginal cost of a copy is very, very low. But the initial cost of actually having any print run done is enormous.
It is.
If I remember correctly, it's pretty high. So,
Yes.
Whereas a photocopier,
And also desktop publishing, that was developing throughout the period. I basically worked a way to get a style for the pamphlets that worked on desktop publishing. And it made them look quite impressive, you know, even though they were only photocopied, these things.
Well, at this point, I do have to add, and we've had conversations about this before, I thought they looked quite amateurish,
in
a good way.
In a way that suggested sincerity and lack of big money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which the reason we were saying these things was because we meant them. And there was a widespread feeling that libertarians were just people who were in it for the money, which is absurd. I mean, you can't make any big money as a libertarian. But also, you're freed from the attentions of donors. The political world is cursed with people who are very good at, I don't know, distributing potatoes or making boilers or toilet paper or something, but they don't know first thing about political propaganda. They think that everything depends on glossy posters and glossy magazines, and if only the public were told about these things, everything would change. The truth is, the public kind of know these ideas, they've heard of them, and the reason they don't agree with them is they don't agree with them. They've looked at them, no, they don't think it's right. So, you know, if you're going to have an impact on it...
Sounds a bit depressing, Brian. I mean, you know,
it is, I know.
That, you know, most people could be persuaded of the value of freedom, not least because
I think people can be persuaded, especially when they're in their formative years, in their teens, which is why the sort of pamphlets we produced, I think it worked, that they appealed to much younger people, because they didn't look, you know, kind of rich and careerist and organized. But also a very important part of the libertarian project Chris and I were involved in was simply helping writers to find their own voice and to say what they wanted to say. We didn't want to tell them what to say. We would simply find out they'd got something libertarian to say. And we'd say, well, have you written it down? Would you like to have a try writing it down? And if it's half reasonable, then we'll publish it. And if only 30 people want to share it...
It didn't I thought your philosophy was it didn't even have to be half reasonable. The whole point was they got published, and then, I mean, this happened to me, and I can see the psychology behind it. It was fair enough. I mean, the first thing I wrote and submitted, you immediately published. It was rubbish. Well, in a sense, yes. It was rubbish. In a sense, it was actually brilliant. But there were a lot of rubbish parts to it. But the point was, after having you know, published this nonsense, I wanted to write, you know, I wanted to retrieve my reputation. And of course,
sort of manipulation going on.
So my next pamphlet was a lot better. And I think there were quite a lot of people who were in that particular boat. And, fair enough. I mean, it was quite clever.
Once they publish something, they know you're on their side, you're helping them to say these things, and that makes them feel better. At a time when they're not necessarily very confident that what they want to say is of any great interest.
No, I certainly wasn't at the time, and it's a big deal to... expose your ideas to you know, an audience like that. Not that I ever got any feedback, it must be said, but
even the fact of doing it, even if you get no feedback, you sort of experience your own ideas somewhat differently, seeing them in print. It's like having it's the next up from having when you do counselling. Just the fact that somebody else is listening to what you're saying enables you to reflect on your thoughts in a different way, look at them more objectively as if from an outside point of view. And therefore you make your arguments more compelling and your thinking starts developing.
Well, we'll certainly hope so.
I think
if you're sensitive, you will do that. I'm slightly frightened by the number of people.
And for example, you attended that event I was at last Friday where basically there was a big shindig in my honour at the IEA. And I was delighted at the number of particularly IEA heavyweights, who clearly remembered the time in their life when I'd said, "What, you know, this is good stuff. You've got something to say. I want to help you say it."
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about people like Steve Davis, who's now written about 3 brilliant books, and there's several more in the pipeline.
I mean, to the extent that he's a man you can't imagine he ever lacked self-confidence. Or needed a boost, but
yes,
it seems he did, and you gave it to him. So,
so he said, and I've learned from experience that when people say things in public, they generally mean them. Obviously, I wasn't the only person who inspired all these characters. You know, one of them was Saeed Kamal, who was running the whole event, and one of them was Mark Littlewood, the boss of the IEA. Apparently, I remember vividly myself. Of course I do. I remember doing a blog posting about the first remarks I heard him make about how he was going to run the IEA, and I remember being very impressed, and I said so in a blog posting, and he seems to have remembered, and that's something to be pleased about. Something I'm proud of. But all of this attitude towards communication began much earlier, when I was not doing politics at all. I was doing ticket selling for theatre productions at Essex University. That's where I got the basic mentality that I needed for this this whole approach to things.
I mean, the way I remember these sorts of sales when I was at university, and I can't imagine things have changed much in the meantime, was that, well, there's some sort of forum at the university where students can flog things and, you know,
yes,
sit behind a desk for their lunch hour. And
yeah,
I presume that's what you did, and you sold your theatre tickets.
I didn't do any libertarian selling at the university.
No.
I was completely passive. I was just observing the absurd antics of the Lenins with hair who were infesting the university, and in this completely delusional state of mind that they really talked as if they thought they could overthrow the British state. I mean, really, what kind of pathetic idea is that?
Nowadays they are the British state.
Yes, that's right.
Well, actually, retired now, of course, but they pretty much had their... Sorry, I'm just going off topic here.
They aren't the whole British state. I think it's easy to exaggerate how powerful these people are, but they certainly wield a lot of clout, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But for me, the big starting point was I'd been floundering around in my teens and 20s trying to find a place in the world that suited me. And first I tried reading architecture. Well, I'm afraid reading architecture, if you want to be an architect, is quite insufficient. So that was a hopeless mess. I still retain an interest in architecture. I write about it and read it. But I knew that the reason I didn't become an architect was that I was hopelessly incapable of doing it. So I then left Cambridge University, where I'd been studying that, and did social studies at Essex University. I knew there was something going
on in
university.
I'm just a little bit curious, Brian, as to why you had to change universities. Is it because you couldn't?
Cambridge was a failure. I was out of there. I mean, they offered me some kind of bodged up degree. You know, I'd leave with a pass. I'd no, I'm not doing it. I'm out of here. I'm going to go to a different university and make a go of it.
Oh, sorry. Does this mean to say you'd actually done 3 years or something? Oh, hang on.
No,
an architecture degree is 7 years, isn't it?
Oh, it goes on forever.
Yeah,
and I realised pretty soon I wasn't going to make the grade. And anyway, architecture, they churn them out on a fantastic scale, and most of them don't become architects. They end up doing something else. And I thought, well, what's the point of that? Given I'm bad at it, why bother? But I learnt a lot about the modern movement, because that was at its height, the height of its influence at the time when I was studying. The professor of architecture was the man who designed, at Cambridge, was the man who designed the Royal Festival Hall. And there was
with the dreadful acoustics.
Yeah, with the world media in classical music acoustics, as you say, yes. And that was a typical modern architecture blunder. They took upon themselves to do too many things and design too many things and solve too many problems. And they weren't willing to basically listen to experts, to make an effort to see who the experts were and then listen to them.
Or to give some respect to tradition and custom.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah.
To inherited knowledge.
Yeah.
And it all improved much, much later. I mean, if only London had built its big concert hall at the time when Birmingham built its big, I can't remember what it's called, but Simon Rattle's big concert hall in Birmingham, which apparently has wonderful acoustics. I've never listened to any music there. I'd love to do that before I snuff it. But they learned the hard way that these acoustics people really should be listened to. And the Royal Festival Hall was built at a sort of 2,000-year low in acoustic competence. Which is to say, architects were just completely ruined.
That's quite an achievement.
And they had £100 million spending on improving it. Didn't do a damn thing. Didn't make a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, and proper good symphony orchestras just don't bother with a Royal Festival Hall. And there's talk, even now, of a new hall somewhere. There was going to be one for Simon Rattle again in London for the LSO, but it came to nothing. Too much money for some reason.
Wow. Hmm.
But maybe one of these decades, London will get itself a decent concert venue. The Barbican's no good.
Yes.
It's not too frightful, but that's about the best you can say, you know.
Oh, wow.
So, but I don't want to give the impression that the reason I didn't become an architect was because architecture was in a very bad state. That that, to me, is a reason to do something. If something's been done very badly, then it makes sense for you to do it and do it better. But I was not capable of doing that. My basic problem as an architect, indeed as an accomplisher of anything, is that I hate complication. My driving force is always to try and simplify, to pick out the principles that really matter, so that the others...
I like to think I'm on the same plane. That's, it's very annoying that life is not as simple as you'd like it to be. As I find every time I try to do anything with my car, it's always a bit more complicated than you think.
Well, cars are covered in complications, aren't they? There are about 10 different things that have to work properly. Carburetors and, you know, fuel injection, all kinds of crap.
And if you ever want to change one piece, that means taking another piece off first.
Anyway. I just can't handle it. But libertarianism is, for me, among other things, one of its great attractions is that it answers some of the more complicated questions in life with a very simple answer. If, for example, you're having a meeting in the top floor of a pub and you're having it about libertarianism, somebody else wants to come in there and play darts, never mind about the relative merits of darts and libertarianism, that's not the question. The question is, who owns the room? Have you hired the room from that owner, or do you already own it? If you do, you can do what you want with it. Property cuts through all these arguments about which are the best plays, which are the best art that needs subsidizing, what's the best kind of healthcare. If you have private property and the freedom to try things out, you do what you want to do. And it's that simple. I find that very appealing.
Yes. I must admit, my appeal was that it answered political questions. If there's a political question out there, you can take a libertarian view. And even to the extent, even when sort of libertarianism is not on the agenda, you can sort of put it onto the agenda by saying, what would happen in a perfectly libertarian world? And that will normally give you the answer that you want.
Certainly give you an answer, an interesting answer that might be well worth talking about, And somebody else would come along and say, you can't say that. But because it's photocopied, then the costs have been kept down to a minimum. Yes, you can say it. We just did. So, anyway, all this began when I finally found my feet in the world as an actor at Essex University. I'd always been a bit frustrated as an actor at school and at Cambridge, where all the acting was done by, you know...
Sorry, Brian, can I just ask one thing? Which is just curious to me personally, but how many years did you do at Cambridge?
I did 2 years. The first year was moderately successful, and it wasn't architecture. It was playing games with shapes, which is not the same thing.
Right.
Because you don't live in a piece of abstract sculpture. You live in a machine that solves the environmental problems. The windows can't leak. The thing has to hold up. And just making sort of cardboard objects is beside the point completely. And I was quite good at that because it was simple. And interestingly, I learned that they actually changed the first year syllabus partly because of me doing it very well and subsequently being a disaster, which gave them a clue that they weren't actually teaching a potential architect. They were just teaching something which was quite beside the point. I mean, there's much more to architecture than the mere... than just producing abstract sculptural shapes, because houses look the way they do because they work.
I mean, it's 50% art and 50% engineering, isn't it?
A lot of it is very technical.
Yeah.
And there were people in the Cambridge School who were infuriated by the casualness of the place towards their particular speciality. I remember passionate lectures from people who were experts on making windows work properly, double glazing, all that sort of stuff. And they say, you've got to get this stuff right. If you don't, you're not an architect. You're just a patent maker and a poseur, you know. Anyway, I went to Essex University because I knew that there was something about university that I needed to crack. I needed to, not in the sense of necessarily getting star exam results, which I ended up not doing anyway, but in the sense that there was something I could learn from being in a university and, well, to put it bluntly, being someone who made a contribution to the place and made people impressed by what I was doing. which I'd never experienced before. And I began by being an actor. I auditioned for some plays, and I appeared in a production called The Duchess of Malfi, which is a very interesting play. I think it's by somebody called Webster, as I recall. And I played a middling part in that. And I was astonished at the ineptness of the publicity. There was a poster produced by the director of the play, which literally people didn't understand. It was a picture, I think it was some sort of animal or something, I don't know why, but literally it was hung up all over the university and nobody had a clue what it was about. And on the first night, there were about 30 people present, you know, friends of the cast, family. That was it. And then the second night, because it was a decent show, the acting was pretty good. You know, there were some good actors. They weren't all as mediocre as me at that time. The word got round that it was quite good, well worth seeing. And about 100 people showed up on the second night. And the third night was packed out. And I remember looking at the numbers and thinking, well, why didn't we, if we could just pack out the first night, hard sell the first night, that would change everything. And that's what happened. The next show was something called The Epic of Gilgamesh. Also, a very interesting play. Even if it's done only half well, it's a good thing to learn about. It's a good show to go and see. It's one of the great works of ancient religious storytelling.
It's one of the earliest works, isn't it? If not the earliest work that's come down to
well,
us.
Well, it's I mean, it's a remarkable story. And
but the point you're making is that if you do it well, the word gets around. And that will sell you your tickets in their sort of university atmosphere,
context.
Yeah.
And why wait? Why not hard sell the first night by saying about the Epic of Gilgamesh what we've just said? You know, it's one of the most interesting pieces of ancient literature that there is. And the whole point of going to university is to learn about things like that, even if the performance itself is only okay. But actually, the performance was quite good. And what I first thing I did, which hadn't been done for the Duchess of Malfi, was to print tickets and sell them.
Hang about. How can you sell tickets without printing them first?
Well, you sell them on the night and hope for the best. I mean, the thing about professionals is that they cover all the bases and have somebody taking care of all functions properly. You know, lighting is done properly, stage design is done properly, directing is done properly, the acting's all adequate. The best of it is more than adequate. And because you're paying all these people, you can jolly well, you know, audition and test and interview people till you get all the functions filled. But amateurs are not like that. They completely screw up whole departments. If you don't have anybody who knows how to do stage lighting, you're not going to have good stage lighting. And the professional theatre is not a good model for amateurs. Or that's, I thought not, because it was causing assumptions to be made about how you did things, which were bad assumptions. And what I did for the Epic of Gilgamesh, first of all, printing tickets beforehand was very important. Second, I slashed the printing bill by printing all the tickets, having all the dates of the shows on them. There were four nights we were doing. Later, we did many more nights when I got better at selling tickets. I was able to say to directors, look, man, I can do this for a week. And when somebody said they were doing King Lear, I said, right, 9 days, we'll fill the whole thing. And we did.
I'm just curious about this remark that you slashed printing costs by printing all the tickets
at
once.
I did it, all the tickets had all the dates of the shows on them. And then by hand, literally by hand, I crossed the box where it said, you know, Monday or Tuesday, whatever the first night was, or the second night. And they were also done with different coloured cardboard,
which meant
that the printing was the same, but the paper was very different.
Which makes it instantly obvious which day you're talking about.
Exactly.
To whoever is on the door.
Not only that, but everybody who buys a ticket knows when it's on. And because they bought a ticket, that means they think it's sensible to buy a ticket. I've sold them on that, or somebody has. And, you know, it's an interesting play. It'll be fun to see. And there is some good acting going on, you know. And so when the Epic of Gilgamesh opened, I was just one of the, you know, a great throng of people playing about six parts each. I did some sort of wise old man seed cross-legged and instructing Gilgamesh about the mysteries of the world. And I played the part of various sort of messengers and, you know, bits and bobs. But when I first went on to do all this, he didn't know me. He didn't know who I was. But after he did his first scene, the guy playing Gilgamesh, I can still remember his name was Craig Lee. He was a rather starry individual. He didn't have that ounce of final ambition which you need to have to become a real actor. But by our standards, he was really very good. And he came off the stage and he said, "Where did all those people come from?" And everyone pointed at me and said, "Oh, that's Brian. He sold them. He filled that place." And suddenly I was someone. As I said, that was what I wanted to be. I wanted to find my feet in the world. And on that evening, I found them. And being told by some tremendously starry actor that you're, you know, he from then on, I was a buddy of his. Because I was giving him what he wanted,
yes,
an audience,
indeed,
you know.
Indeed.
And the next, there were three nights for the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think we did. I can't remember, it may have been four, I can't remember. But the first night wasn't completely packed out, but it was mostly packed. And the other nights were all full up. So we did a good job on it. And I remember talking to the director when she announced she was going to do this. And I said, "Look, leave it to me. I will do the publicity. I know what I'm doing." And although I didn't know fully, I knew that of all the people who were thinking of doing it, I was the one who was going to put my back into it and do some clever stuff and make it sell. And that's what happened.
I realize here there's a bit, I think there's a bit missing, or maybe you've said it and I've forgotten it, but how did you do the publicity?
Well, for Gilgamesh, what I did was I produced a relatively small printed piece of information, actually rather like the square of information for the Libertarian Alliance pamphlets that I did.
That one in the bottom right-hand corner, which...
kind of thing. And then what I did was I handmade lots of posters with literally handwritten quotes from this rather interesting text. You know, there was some fun dialogue.
It wasn't even printed?
No.
Oh, wow.
So that saved a mass of money. And as you know, surely, the size of what you print massively increases what it costs. So to have a small thing, just, you know, spray can glued onto the corner of it at the bottom, is excellent. And what that meant was I was able to fill the university with about 30 or 40 posters, each one of which was unique. And people started wandering around and spotting them and saying, "Oh, look, here's another of these." And
I'm trying to visualize the size. It'd be A4 size, that sort of thing, would it?
No, it was a bit smaller than that.
Oh, right, okay.
The card I put on, it was more like A3 or A2, which again made it much cheaper. But the posters were about A2, I think. They were just big sheets of paper with I think I may have done some sort of stenciling thing with the characters, you know, spray can. But the idea that you hand make a poster is typical of the way I didn't accept the normal way you do things. I mean, the Colchester Rep, which was the local repertory theatre in the town, they would never have dreamt of doing posters like this. They would just have produced one poster and filled the town with it and hoped that everybody saw it once and that they were in the habit of going to theatre anyway, so they'd go. But this was completely different. So, you know, I suddenly was Mr. OK when it came to doing publicity. And what I learned from all this was not any particular technique for using communications technology by cutting the cost and maximizing its impact, but just generally that this was something you could do. Technology was changing very fast all the time at that time. These plays were being sold in the early 70s. Well, the personal computer was still a blink in people's eye, although I'd been shown it by some of the people in the guys who did the lighting, actually, for some of our shows. They showed me a very early and primitive word processor, and I thought, wow, I'm going to do that. That's my life right there. I must learn to touch type. I must, with all my fingers, you know, and not take anything for granted, and certainly not live the life where you pass all your writing on to a female department, which does the typing. That was all going to go. I could see that.
Which is odd, because it took another 20 years to go, didn't it?
But I knew that was going to happen. And eventually, things like Fleet Street just wouldn't have these great big plaques of secretaries all just typing yet again what they've been given to type out by the men. That was all going to stop. The men were either going to learn to do their own typing or have to get another job doing something sensible. So for me, the theatrical experience was formative.
Yeah.
Even though most other people would look at it and think, oh, well, doesn't amount to much. And, of course, there are plenty of other people doing the same sort of thing in other universities that I knew nothing about. But I was solving the problems that I was faced with and that the theatre people were faced with, and it worked. It worked.
Good. Do you think that is related to your work with the LA?
Yes, very much so. Yes, not in any detailed sense of, you know, using the printing press the way I used it.
But it's more the principles of the things.
Keeping costs down is crucial. Don't waste your time trying to get lots of money and then use it really well to kick up a storm. That's a delusion.
Would you say this is related to an idea that you've mentioned to me a few times over the years, the difference between a baby thing and a loaf of bread thing?
Yes.
And you say, you know, half a baby is not much use, but half a loaf of bread is actually quite useful. So you look for things, especially in the sort of, you know, when you don't have any money, you look for things where a half a thing would be quite useful.
Yes, that's right. If you can sell some tickets for the first night, not as many as you'd like, but some, then that is a real step in the right direction.
Yeah, exactly.
That sort of thing, yes. And if you produce a pamphlet by Patrick Crozier about rail privatisation or something, well, if you can sell 200 of them, then great. But if you can only sell 30, well, that's 30 more than nothing. And that's good. And you've got the chance to see your ideas, as it were, in print. I mean, not actually in print, but looking kind of as if they are in print. They feel published to you, and that changes your attitude to what you've written and your feeling of confidence about being able to do more of it in the future.
Yes, undoubtedly.
And one of the things that I was very gratified with last Friday was the way that people said I was very good at sort of catalyzing them to understand their own thinking. And I think that's true. I think, if I am allowed to boast a bit, I think what made me into a good libertarian editor was that I wasn't trying to stitch my own opinions onto the side of the opinions of this writer by pushing something I was interested in. I was simply saying, what are you trying to say? I want to hear it. I want you to hear it. I want you to see it and think about it and make as much of it as you can. Because given that you're a libertarian, it's bound to be of interest to me.
In fact, you did say when you're in trouble, having difficulty writing, just what is it you want to say?
Yeah.
And now write that down.
Yes, exactly.
Which is actually quite... Yeah.
Put your pen down, take your fingers off the keyboard, tell me now, what are you trying to say here? And amazingly, people are incredibly eloquent if you just say that to them.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons I like these podcasts. You can just nail down what you're trying to say. Because talking is natural. Humans talk, unless they're brought up on desert islands and don't ever get the chance to talk with other people. Whereas writing is an effort. You have to learn to do it. You have to study it. And it's never come completely naturally to be writing, and I think that's true of most people.
Yeah.
A bit of an effort. Yeah. You have to put in the graft.
You do.
So one of the best ways to write is to say to yourself, what I write is when I'm at my most eloquent. You know, it's if I'm saying all the right things. And the beauty of writing is you can chop it out and start again and do another go and go on at it until you say it right. Another thing I wanted to do with writers was, when they produced a piece of writing, it was often the case that what was needed was to put on the front a little introduction which says, here's what I'm going to say. This is the case I'm going to make. Quite apart from anything else, if somebody reads just that first paragraph, they've still got a lot of the point of the piece, even if they choose not to read the rest of it. So it's one of those. It's a slice of bread you're offering at the beginning, rather than just.
I don't remember that with LA pamphlets. Because LA pamphlets are very short. So,
well, it usually applied more to longer ones, but there were certain writers who were a bit prolix and complicated, and they needed to get into the habit of nailing down in a couple of sentences what they were on about. And then when you've got the first couple of sentences put right at the beginning, fine. Then the rest of the pamphlet follows. That's what you're saying. And at the end, you have another couple of sentences saying, this is what I've said. And then, equally interesting, you have another few sentences saying, and this is why it matters. This is why this pamphlet was worth reading and worth me writing, because this is a significant issue. If everybody did what I'm recommending, this is how the world would be a better place, you know.
I
don't think that applies as much to your writing, because I think you were in the habit of doing that sort of thing anyway. But I can think of a few writers who let's say they weren't very good at experiencing their writing as if from outside, and didn't realise that it was all a bit complex and maybe a bit confusing. And they were the ones who needed to be encouraged to clarify their message. And of course, the process of clarifying your message means you learn your message better. You reflect on what it's saying, and you become more eloquent. And I think that's all part of why I helped libertarians to find their voice, because I was getting them to nail it down and clarify it, you know, and also not just say it, but say why it was worth saying. And compared to that, me wanting them to write particular things was completely beside the point. Factor in what Chris Tame always used to say: we need our people everywhere. We need people thinking about how to be libertarian politicians, how to be libertarian activists, how to be libertarian academics of all kinds, how to just be libertarians and get on with their lives.
I mean, I was going to suggest there's perhaps another reason, is that in the British libertarian scene, there aren't a lot of us, so we can't really afford to be sectarian about this. We can't really afford a Randroid versus Rothbardian split.
Yes.
Although we've had, of course, splits, and that was the last but one.
But it was subtly different from what you've described. In my thinking at the time, the split was between one team that did want to have a rather sectarian view of things, and the Chris Tame team, despite him being very Randian, he wasn't a Randroid, and he was all in favour of publishing very varied kinds of writing. And it mattered a hell of a lot that if what somebody wanted to say might be quite obscure, you know, here's the theological reasons why God is in favour of libertarianism. And Chris's attitude, and mine, was, well, that sounds interesting. Why does God think that? Please tell us, you know, quote from the Bible, whatever it is. And if only 30 people wanted to read that, well, so be it. Like we said, you know, 30 people is 30 more than nothing. And maybe the third time they've written this stuff down, they'll hit the jackpot and say something in a way that's more widely appealing.
Yes.
And if they do, and it's an LA pamphlet, well, there's nothing to stop you producing another 200 copies of it, of the photocopy. It's an effort, but what I think, looking back on it, one of the basic principles is that amateur activities can often include almost ludicrously hand-done activities. I mean, all those multi-page LA pamphlets, the big long ones by people like Finley Dunnicky, and he's the one I remember, but also I think
David Botsford did a few long ones, didn't he?
Yes, he did, indeed. And though they were literally done with, they were hand-stapled with a big long arm stapler and hand folded very carefully and made sure they looked good. And the thing is, if you're operating as an amateur on a very small scale, then you can do lots of these things, but literally by hand with the necessary kit. You know, in my case, it was a long arm stapler, which was very important, which meant that I could fold an A3 sheet of paper, fold another A3 sheet of paper, and put them together and staple them down the middle in a way that was much more satisfactory than just stapling them at the corner, like a bunch of documents copied in an office.
Yes. Were there particular pamphlets that got a lot more time on the photocopier that you should like? You'd print 20 and then you'd have to print 20 more, and then 20
honestly,
more.
Yes, that did happen, yes. Mm-hmm. I can't remember now which ones they were. But you never knew beforehand which ones were going to be suddenly of interest to all sorts of people. And it was helpful not having to fret about that. And as I say, a very important part of this was the storage costs, both in printing costs and in sheer volume of office space needed or not needed to accommodate all these pamphlets. But best of all, as soon as I'd done a pamphlet, then the next question was, well, what's the next pamphlet going to be and what's it going to be about? Not how am I going to sell all these piled up copies of this thing? And you, if you do that, you get diverted into selling what you've done rather than producing more and being able to cover a table at a conference with about 100 titles, you know, which people can look through and choose the ones they want. So
I do remember this at various conferences I attended, normally at the New Cavendish Club in Marble Arch. And yes, it was quite impressive, the number you had, because it'd be like a table, yes, or maybe two tables were covered in LA pamphlets.
More. Yeah, I remember we went to one, there were three tables, and I heard people saying, my God, they have got a lot of stuff here.
Yeah.
And none of that would have been possible if it had been all printed. It would have cost a fortune. We'd have had businessmen telling us how to do it in a stupid way, and it would all have come to nothing. And that vital clarity of libertarian voice would have been compromised by the worrying about whether it would attract enough attention. We didn't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I certainly think, I mean, from my own point of view, is the LA was a lot more, or LA publications were a lot more influential than, say, anything by the ASI, Adam Smith Institute.
I think they were influential in a quite different way.
Yeah.
To different people. I mean, they were talking to a different market, really.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the ASI did have a very big impact, actually. But they were amongst those who wanted successful policies that would be picked up by the politicians. And they did that very well. And they raised money, and they made sure their donors were on side and weren't telling them to do stupid things, and they just made it all work. And I had a great respect for Madsen and Amon, and I still do.
Yeah.
And a huge respect for the Institute of Economic Affairs. But that didn't mean I copied their techniques the same each time. You know, beautiful printed books with spines costing a fortune. Because we didn't have the space for that. And we didn't want to have to worry about it.
Or the money to print them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Economically, my life has always been about cutting costs rather than maximizing income. I've never been good at making money, but I've always been good at not spending it too much.
Mm.
And since I inherited a great gob of cash from my parents, that worked. Plus, I don't have complicated tastes in personal life any more than I do in life generally.
Well, I dread marriage
because I dread the sort of the weakening of my own autonomous right to think and say exactly what I think and say. I mean, look at Boris Johnson. You get the feeling his latest wife seems to occupy about half of his head. I couldn't bear to live like that.
Well, so that's why libertarians can't get a girlfriend, I'd guess.
No, this particular libertarian hasn't got himself a girlfriend. We're all different from each other, aren't we? And
That's true.
No, there are lots of us who've got families and bringing up children very, very well, and I've got nothing but respect for these people. I'm very glad to have married friends who are bringing up very delightful children. I make a point of visiting them and generally praising them for what they're doing, because I think it's very valuable. I think it's a very good thing to do. But I'm just not very good at it myself, that's all. So I haven't done it. So it is all very personal and not likely to be of universal interest to anybody who doesn't think I am myself of great interest, but maybe there are a few people for whom what I've been doing and how I've been doing it is of some interest, and they may find this interesting. I hope so. I certainly did at the time. I remember being very engaged and involved in all of these clever things I was doing. I also ought to mention that when it came to ticket selling at Essex University, there was another guy called Steve Klein. I don't know what he's doing now, but he was a fellow ticket seller. He joined me in that enterprise. And it's only fair to just make a nod towards him. But there were also some very good actors. By the end of it, I myself became a not half bad actor, which took me a long time, but I got there.
This is on the basis that you were being given the opportunity because you were selling the tickets. They thought you were a person who
I got the opportunity because I was a half-decent actor.
Yeah, okay.
And by the end, I was more than a half-decent actor. I mean, I remember somebody came up to me at the end of my time as an actor at Essex and said, "Brian, I've seen you in lots of things, but I never realised you could act." Which I thought was quite funny. But I knew I wasn't very good to start with, and I'd got better, so I took it in. I was very happy to be told that.
Maybe you were so good an actor they didn't know you were acting.
No, it was better than that. They could see I was acting. When my final part was one of the rude mechanicals in Midsummer Night's Dream, I had 6 lines, and guess what? I knew all those lines. Most amateurs don't know their lines.
Oh, dear.
No wonder they're crap at acting, because they don't know what's coming next, and they're spending their whole time fretting about what it is, rather than putting it across properly. And I had 6 lines, and I got 8 laughs. I got 6 laughs for every line I gave, and one exit and one other thing I did, which wasn't a line at all. It was just a reaction. It was just a laugh in response to somebody else's lines. And I got 2 extra laughs without saying anything. I was actually half decent as an actor. But I didn't want to be an actor. It didn't interest me for my life.
No.
I mean, England's full of super capable actors, including lots who've not made a living at it, had to go and work in country clubs and whatnot. And I didn't want to be a person like that. I wanted to do libertarianism. I'd already worked out that was what I was going to put my life into.
I mean, it's certainly interesting to me that if you show me a TV program or a film from the 60s, I can have a stab at naming quite a lot of the actors, because in those yes. days there just weren't that many.
So there was just a little sort of stage company of TV actors who kept on appearing in everything, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
And whereas nowadays, it seems to me there are huge numbers. I mean, it's 10 times as many people making a living out of acting somehow, or certainly from recorded acting, shall we say? But I'm not sure how the theatre's doing. I just think it's probably doing a lot worse than it was 50 years ago.
Mm. Well, whatever it was, it didn't appeal to me as a career.
No. No.
But the process of learning how it works and how to do it as an amateur, not as a professional, was it gave me what Perry de Haviland calls a meta context of how to use communications at a time when communications have never been more dynamic and changing and developing than they were during this period.
Well, I was going to ask you about this because, I mean, it seems to me that the advent of the internet just solved all these problems in an instant.
Yeah, all absolutely. Of a sudden, and I was in the right frame of mind to realise this. I mean, when Perry de Haviland showed me Sammy's data, I just looked at it and I said, yes, there it is. I remember a talk that our mutual friend Antoine Clark gave about, wouldn't it be nice, he said, if we could all have lots of glossy magazines and write articles, not just narrowly about libertarianism, but about with the sort of implication that life could be good fun and you could sort of write about sport in a way that assumed kind of libertarian ideas behind it, without obsessing about it. And being a man of great intelligence, Antoine didn't waste any time actually trying to start a magazine like this. But ironically, when the internet arrived and blogging arrived, there it was. Suddenly it was possible to do what he'd talked about.
And of course you were in the mood anyway, because I think you had, was it Free Life? You'd sort of written a few things on classical music and architecture,
yes,
probably.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had. Yes. And a very unsatisfactory format. Carrying sort of, I still think the periodical magazine is a bit of a sideshow. The great thing about blogging is that you can make the piece as long or as short as it needs to be, and you can say exactly what you want, and you do not have to worry about how many people are going to want to read it. So it's kind of the ultimate LA pamphlet.
Yes.
And when Perry showed it to me, I said, yes, here we are. Voila.
And it sort of annoys me with our other podcasts. I mean, we just go and talk for as long as we like. Eventually we run out of things to say, and that's it. We'll stop there.
Yes. And I also like the fact that we don't have a lot of irrelevant music, because we're not, you know, if you're interested in what we're going to talk about, then a bit of music's just going to get in the way. If you're not interested, then no amount of musical enticement is going to make any difference. It's going to be annoying.
I think you said one thing, I think may have been in one of our TV podcasts, was that the whole idea that music and the intro to a TV programme is the statement to everyone, come and gather around, there's something going on.
Yeah.
Which is pointless on the internet, because the audience is already there. They're listening, they're waiting for you to say something or do something, just get on with
it. Yeah, if you want to say something, just start saying it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And these little conversations of ours have all the same quality about them. Of not having to, neither of us having to fret about how many people download it to start with. We can just get on and say things that are of interest and of interest to us, and hope others are diverted. But if they aren't, well, okay, they're not. So be it.
Well, it's not. Well, we are. But I think it's worth pointing out that some people I've interviewed in the past were rather keen to know how many people were listening. So
yes,
there is that.
Well, it's not that many. It's sort of dozens, isn't it, at the moment?
I think a good one might get up to 30, and you don't know how many are actual real people and how many are robots.
Yes.
So, but hey-ho.
But, it's better than nothing.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And it's whiles away an afternoon, so...
yes,
it's an interesting conversation. Exactly. I mean, if it's interesting for the two of us, I think it's... It's worth doing. It's certainly interesting. It's certainly interesting for me.
All of this stuff tonight, I can well understand somebody listening to this conversation saying, this is about as interesting as listening to somebody telling us about how he does his job, you know, whatever it happens to be, bus conductor or, you know, delivery driver. And frankly, I don't want to hear about it. You know, like these bores at parties. You ask them what they do and half an hour later they're still telling you, which is why most men are very frightened of doing that. I actually like hearing about people's work, but most people don't. Most men especially are very frightened of boring people about what they do, and they tend to be rather evasive about it. But if you can convince them you really are interested in what they're talking about, it can get very fascinating. I mean, for example, just recently I've become acquainted with the guy who bosses the project to build Crossrail. Fascinating guy.
I would think so.
Basically the story is that when he was in charge of the project, it went ahead satisfactorily. And when he went back to Boston, it all ran into the sand and stopped working. So he obviously is doing something right. Maybe he was just
creating problems for later, sort of kicking the can down the road. You never know. With this sort of thing.
Well, I didn't
I mean,
get
I mean,
that.
I prefer the original version. Yes, everything was a competent one. He was doing it.
I do believe what I've said. I think he was. I talked to him and asked him, you know, what are the principles you apply when you're trying to get to grips with a piece of infrastructure that seems to be running into trouble? And he, once he was convinced I really was interested in the answer, which I definitely am and was, he started telling me, and it made very good sense. Very good sense indeed. And it's quite subtle because a lot of infrastructure is, the work is obtained by people who knowingly underprice what they're going to do. And then when they've got the job, they start adding prices to it. And that causes endless difficulties. And Crossrail, there's a whole extra dimension of complexity caused by the fact that there are about five different computer systems for running trains, not one of which can be just got rid of. You can't just say we're going to use one system for the whole line. For some reason, that can't work. You've got to join up different systems, and that is one hell of a task.
Yes.
And it means getting contractors to work with each other, and that's quite an art.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So it's very interesting. He was at the last Friday, the thing we were at, where people took it in turns to say nice things about me.
Oh, wow. Oh, I didn't know that.
He's there. Yeah, he's a friend of a friend, you know.
That's very nice, yes.
Yeah, it is. And I think he was rather surprised at what he heard, you know. He knew I was some sort of libertarian, but he didn't realise I'd impressed people like the ones who were impressed, which is, again, I'm not one of these people who is confident that I've lived a good life and done good things. I really like being told I have. I value the high opinion that other people have of me, and I fret when people have a very low opinion of me.
I must confess, I'm surprised to hear that.
Well, you might not think so, given my demeanour, but it's true. I tell you, it definitely is.
Yeah, I'm...
I mean, you can't. One thing, you can't please everybody, that's for sure. And I know that. But if you've pleased a few people that you whose opinions you value, you know, if you've got somebody like Saeed saying that I provided him with a bit of a response and a belief that he had something to say and would be a very special person in due course, at a time when he wasn't sure that that would be true. But now here he is, member of the House of Lords, successful MEP. He's a really brilliant and expert politician. And I think I could see that a bit early. I could see him, the qualities he had made me notice this and made me want to encourage him to say whatever he wanted to say. Hello?
I'm still here. I'm just trying to say something intelligent, and I can't think of anything intelligent to say.
Well, how did you experience me as an editor? Did you feel your confidence a bit boosted by having your dealings with me and getting things published?
Certainly in the case of the rail privatisation thing, I did.
Yeah.
Although I had already published for the Friends of the Union a few years beforehand.
Yes.
I did something called Ulster for Beginners. So I had some confidence that I could actually write a pamphlet if I put my mind to it. I think your influence on me is actually much more personal. It's things about the way you think and the way you're prepared to challenge me.
But the purpose of these challenges was always me digging into what you're saying rather than disagreeing with you in any straightforward way. I mean, disagreement is a technique of refining the question, what exactly are you saying? But that was always my agenda. You know, what are you getting across here with this piece of writing about rail privatisation?
Sort of
why does it matter?
Oh, well, I can't remember you saying that. But you, I think
I think maybe I was less of an editor for you than I was for some of these other characters. But the other thing is that if I had things to say about what libertarianism meant to me, and if I had sort of clever thoughts about it, well, it was up to me to write those thoughts down like I was another writer, you know, not for me to try and get some other author to accept what I'd said and write it for me. That was completely beside the point.
And
does that make sense?
Well, you never did that, did you? I mean, it was always, you know, what do you want to write? Go ahead and write it.
Which
is a good thing.
Especially, as I say, given that we need lots and lots of different attitudes and mentalities and interests. I mean, for example, I remember one guy, Barry McLeod Cullinane, who I encouraged to write things, who subsequently got deep into local government. Well, to put it mildly, that's not to everybody's taste, but it is to his taste. And he did that, and good for him. As a result, we've got a libertarian who can... If you want to know about local government, he's the man to talk to. He'll tell you about it. And, you know, if somebody else becomes a member of the House of Lords, they can talk to Saeed about how you do that. Saeed can tell them all about how he does things.
Well, hopefully there are a few more podcasts in the future.
That'd
be nice to think of.
I think there'll be more general interest, I think, than just this one. But you never know, do you, beforehand? It could be that this is just the sort of slightly esoteric stuff that people don't normally hear from podcasters and libertarians, and it might suddenly, you know, take off. There might be 100 downloads. I'm not saying it will, but it could happen. And if it does, it's all there. They can do it.
Yeah, it's easy to do, and it's you try to think how this could possibly have been done 50 years ago when you're at the University of Essex. I mean, you need a TV channel. That's what you'd need, or a radio show.
Yes, and so much about how to communicate is conditioned by the fact that they've got this expensive infrastructure which they've got to make maximum use of all the time. And they've got to be in this state of almost permanent frenzy, keeping people excited about what they're saying, which is all rather bogus. I think one of the surprises of the internet has been the way that the best and most successful talkers on the internet have been able to go on for 2.5 hours. Who saw that coming?
Is that true? I don't know.
I think so. I think Rogan and Peterson and these people, the ones who really got something to say, broad interest, they're really able to dig into these subjects in a way that mainstream broadcasters are constantly, you know, they're constantly interrupted by the producer saying, yeah, this is all getting a bit boring. Speed it up. Make it clearer. You know, change the subject. We're losing viewers. That kind of thing.
I mean, I've never listened to a whole Joe Rogan show or, a whole
I have a few times.
Okay.
But the thing is, people always say attention spans are falling. I don't agree. I think for something that they're very interested in and want to attend to, people can attend for vast amounts of time. And what they don't have is an attention span for something they don't want to hear. They're more likely to switch off and go somewhere else if they don't like what they're hearing, finding it tedious. Anyway, I think I'm done. If you want to say more, of course, I want to hear it. But I think I've said most of what I had in mind to say.
Well, I mean, we've covered your time selling tickets at Essex, the University of Essex, in some detail, much more detail than I was expecting. I'm not sure. Was there anything we missed in terms of the LA? I don't think so. Actually, there was one little question I wanted to ask. This photocopier, because I remember this photocopier, it was in your kitchen for decades, even after it ceased to be used, I think. It was there for about 15 years.
Oh, I know. It was sentimental value to me. I hated the moment when I had to get rid of it, but I did.
Yeah.
Because it was just taking
How expensive an object was it when it was first bought?
Not that expensive. It cost several thousand quid to buy. It cost about 2,000 quid, right. So it was quite expensive.
This is 1981 pounds or something like that?
Yes.
Right,
yes.
Okay. So, wow.
I was making big life-altering decisions when I made things like, when I bought things like that.
And so that was kind of a baby thing then?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
It was.
I owned it, and it mattered to me that I could control it and produce all these pamphlets. And then... I got my flat in the early 90s, and that's where we did all these mail shots, which you've said very kind things about in the past.
I'll say them again. They were like manna from heaven. I mean, it was the excitement you'd get from this. I can't remember how you mailed them, but you know, you'd open it. I can't remember if it was in an envelope or I seem to remember a plastic cover, but that can't be true. And they were just wonderful.
A big brown envelope, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it was just envelope. You just knew there were just ideas that were just really exciting in them. They were just tremendous. Made a huge difference at that time. Good things.
All before the internet, when all that excitement kind of became universal.
Yeah, and almost routine nowadays.
Yes. Yes,
I mean it's a bit of a shame. I mean, the internet to me seems not as exciting as it was. When did we start? 2002, 2003, something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, Transport Blog was 2002. It was very exciting.
The first thing the Libertarian Alliance did with the internet was to shovel all these pamphlets onto the internet, and they're even now being read as old PDF files, with ancient desktop publishing. They still look quite pretty.
And, of course, Rob is converting them into proper HTML, which is nice to know. And,
yes, yes. More to the point, he's picking out his favourites. So, you know, my best bits are not being smothered to death by all the other bits I've done about, you know, photos of adverts on taxis, which I find entertaining, but, you know, the world can live without that, frankly. But my whole attitude to personal blogging was that if I just noticed things and reported what I enjoyed noticing, that some bigger principles would emerge from this, eventually of the sort that could be done as, you know, pieces of authentic libertarian writing, because they illustrate some fundamental point about what life is all about.
You mean to say that ads on taxis might have some? You can go from there to some more general point.
Yeah, I picked them because so far they haven't. But I'll give you an example of the sort of idea which has slowly crept up on me. And that is that architecture is now, there are two opposite camps fighting each other. There are conservatives who want to live in Poundbury and who think tower blocks are the work of Satan, and there are people who think the opposite, and they're both sincere in their likes and dislikes. And I want both of them to get what they want. I want people who want to live in the ye olde village on the south coast, even if it's fake. There's nothing wrong with faking antiquity. It's happened a lot over the years. But I also want to be able to live in London, gaze at the skyline from 20 miles away. I think London's massively more entertaining than it used to be. And I've had great fun photographing.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you'll catch an episode of The Sweeney. And it wasn't difficult for them to find some fairly grim parts of London in those days.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Because it hadn't really.
And the way that these towers dominate the opening credits of seemingly every other TV show which is set in London is it shows that there are a lot of people like me who have a real fondness for these very eccentric and oddly shaped buildings. You know, the Gherkin and the Shard, and the cheese grater, and all these things.
Yeah.
I love them. But partly I love them because the magic of a city is simply numbers. The fact that there are so many people living right on top of each other that when they go out and have coffee and bump into each other, all sorts of creative things start happening.
Yes.
You know, if you want to
meet. Does that mean that in this year where people haven't been able to bump into each other, we'll have a sort of dearth of creativity? It'd be how would you measure it? How would you know?
I don't know. I think there's some truth in that. Were it not for the fact that people have found virtual ways of filling those gaps, which in the long term may prove to be even more significant. You know, a lot of work is going to get done at home that wouldn't have been because of this latest episode.
Yeah.
And the whole question of how you organize work and how, you know, what is the role of face-to-face meetings is very interesting to me. I mean, one thing I haven't slackened off with over the last 20 years is just having meetings in my home. I've kept on doing that. And again, the agenda
Brian,
is...
Brian, there was a gap. There was a gap.
Yeah, there was. You're right, there was. But it didn't last long. I soon realised that it was a mistake to have shut them down. And because although we were able to say lots of things, the opposition got their act together and started dominating the social media, which I never got to grips with. I switched off at that point. I never wanted to master Twitter and Facebook. I don't like them.
No, I find them hard work.
Hmm.
And you know, it was amazing how quickly they turned nasty.
Yes, it was. And I didn't see that coming.
No. Glenn Reynolds did. He said, you know...
Oh, yes, lots of people did, but I wasn't one of them.
No.
So I've carried on with blogging. I think it's good stuff. And Glenn Reynolds carried on with blogging because he saw that the social media were going to have severe penalties attached to them, like anti-leftists weren't going to be able to speak their mind.
Yeah.
Or not successfully.
No.
I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens to the whole woke project in the next few years. We've both expressed optimism that it's going to get some backlash to it. I hope that's true. But I leave it to younger people to do that.
Well, yes, I think you have said that being of the age you are, you have no right to impose your views on a younger generation. And I'm starting to feel that too. And
I have the right, but I can't demand that they pay attention, and then they're less likely to, is what I feel.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. But so saying, I have this sort of feeling of a younger generation communicating with each other in a way that I simply will never understand.
Yeah.
No matter how hard I try. So don't bother. Just you know, plough your own furrow and...
Be your age, yes.
Yeah. And just accept that the blogging may be a slightly out-of-date technology, but it's the one that, you know, I understand.
Suits so us. Yes.
I'll continue with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, me too. I've still got some things I want to say about the world and especially about history. I've been reading Deirdre Mikulski's book. You remember?
Well, we talked about her in the Industrial Revolution.
Yes,
the much-delayed Industrial Revolution podcast.
Mm.
Yeah.
But since then, at the time, I admitted I hadn't read everything of her trilogy. I still haven't read all of it, but I've read a lot more of it. And there is one name, surprise, surprise, Immanuel Todd, whom she does not drop. She drops every other name you can think of who's ever written anything about these matters. People she agrees with, people she disagrees with. But she doesn't drop Immanuel Todd's name, and this is a serious mistake on her part.
Now, is that because she hasn't read him,
look one of these heavyweight intellectuals in the eye and say, "North, you know, you got this wrong. You need to go back and finish this." But that is exactly what I think about McCloskey's work. Basically, what she says happened in the British 18th century is true. It did happen. But her argument that it happened could be much stronger and should be. And I'm going to go on saying it until I either drop dead or she shows some sign of having got the message.
This sounds... I could go on and I could ask you about this, but...
No, do that for another time.
Yeah.
No,
let's do that.
That's an example of something it's up to me to write and talk about. And basically, I'm not able to do blogging from the hospital because the internet connection is such a mess.
Well, that's what this is for. Is we can do a look. If it only takes 15 minutes, we can do a 15 minute podcast. That's fine. It doesn't have to be an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's we have
true.
That freedom. So
We can do that if I'm not going to get anywhere. Okay. But soon I should be home and I'll be able to write this down and choose my words carefully. So it should be okay. But it is a great source of solace to me that if I don't have time to do all the writing I want to do, I can at least, as you say, whistle through it in one of these conversations.
Well,
that matters a lot to me.
Good. Are we done? Can I press stop?
I think
that's
we are.
Okay, I'll press stop.